When we lived in Colorado, for the first couple of years we lived there, when we had the opportunity to move there, I was convinced if I was going to live there, I was going to live in the mountains. So if any of you have been out there for the feast or for to visit or anything, you'll know that half the state is as flat as Kansas. It's not till you get west of Denver that there's mountains, and then they go almost north and south all the way through the state. But I did not want to live in the flat part. I wanted to live up in the mountains. So we moved up into a little town called Woodland Park. It's a small community. It's at 8,500 feet, and we very much enjoyed it. But we got to know a type of person that I hadn't met in my travels, even though I'd grown up in a rural area. In the mountains, there are people who like to be referred to as mountain people. And I'm sure it's in the Appalachians and other mountain chains as well. But these are people who move to the mountains because they want to get away from other people. And some of our friends, our daughter became friends with someone at school, and we got to know the parents some. But the mother was a very sweet lady. The father, though, was somewhat of a rebel, and he and his family bought 100 acres or so out in the middle of nowhere, Colorado. And they did that so that the neighbors couldn't see what they were doing or wouldn't complain about anything. And he had some habits that I also enjoyed. For example, we walked out his sliding glass door onto his back deck, and that's where he had his skeet set up so that we could just sit there on the back deck and shoot the shotguns out into the field. So he just had it, he'd say pull, and it would throw it, and we would shoot at it. That was kind of fun, but he did other things like cockfighting and stuff like that, which, of course, I wouldn't agree with, but he wanted to be away from other people so he could do what he wanted to do. Sometimes we call them hermits, and if you've ever heard the term hermit crab, they're called that for a reason. They live alone in their shells, and they don't congregate with other crabs. They're loners, and they don't get along well with others, and so that's why they're called hermit crabs. And we know if we call somebody a hermit, we know that because they have separated themselves from other people. Well, that's not how God wants us to live. Now, maybe you have thought before, I would like to get away from everybody else. Like Randy and Amber, they decided they wanted to get away from us, and so they move away. But we know that so much of life, so much of Christianity, so much of the Bible is about relationships. First and foremost, our relationship with God, and then it's about our relationships with other people. And even with Thanksgiving coming up, and thinking about gratitude, when you give thanks in your prayers, what do you give thanks for? The very first thing I give thanks for is life. I try to anyway, because without life, you can't give thanks for anything. So the first thing I try to think of to give thanks for is the fact that God has created life and given us life. And then I try to give thanks that God is involved in my life at this time. And then I give thanks for the people in my life, my wife, my children, my parents, you, the congregations, God's people. That's how the order of things that I tend to try to give thanks for. Our lives are about relationships. Our lives are about people. We shouldn't spend our lives trying to get away from people. We have to learn to deal with people. We have to learn, of course, first and foremost, to have that good relationship with God and then good relationship with people. When you look at life, it's about if you're married, marriage, there's our parents, there's our children, there's our neighbors, there's our co-workers. It's about relationships. There's our in-laws. I think I've mentioned to you before that I get along with my in-laws very well because they live way up in northern Wisconsin and we don't see them often. That was meant to be a joke. She didn't laugh, so it wasn't a funny joke. But they're very loving people, and I wish we saw them more. But it's about relationships. And it's important to view relationships as God views relationships. Every one of us, to some degree or another, are influenced by society. and how society views relationships. Of course, we want and we should desire to be influenced by God's Spirit and by what's in Scripture. And we should want to view relationships the same way God views relationships. When you look around society today, there's just so much hate and there's so much anger. And sometimes watching the news, I have to turn it off because I can't stand to watch some of the things. And I don't know if any of you saw this, and I'm not going to go through a bunch of horror stories, but this past week on the news, they had this videotape. Actually, the people that were doing it videotaped it, and then they put it on YouTube. But there was a group of young people that were on a subway in New York. They were on the deck of the subway, or whatever that's called there, the platform, waiting to get on a train. And they decided to look for someone to punch, to beat up. And they found an elderly man. Well, he's in his late 50s. And they walked up to him, and they just slugged him. One punch knocked him out. He fell backwards. He was completely knocked out there. Someone did come up to help him. But they laughed about it, and they got on the train. And then they posted it on the internet for whoever wanted to view it. So what view of life is that? What view of relationships is that? And we could go on and on about terrorists and suicide bombs and all kinds of things that show that with the influence of Satan and human nature, you mix that together, and there's not a value of life. There's not a value of relationships. And this world is full of this hatred and hurt and adversity. And we know that's related to Satan. It's not related to God. God's view of relationships is the opposite. So today the sermon is titled, Godly Principles to Live By in Our Relationships. Godly Principles to Live By in Our Relationships. And I'm not going to teach you anything new. I should say, chances are, I won't teach you anything new, but I challenge you to take these principles and to ask yourself, as I ask myself, the same thing. Are we applying them in our lives? We're going to go through some godly principles about relationships, and they can be applied to any relationship we have. So for those of you who are married, you can apply this in your marriages. Those of you who have children, those of you who have parents or neighbors or co-workers, so nobody should be left out. Every one of us should be able to use these principles in our relationships. And when you look here in Matthew chapter 5, verse 21, says, "You have heard that it was said to those of old," meaning those under the law of Moses, "you shall not murder." So we have the commandment, you shall not murder. So Matthew 5:21, "You shall not murder, and whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. But Christ says that for us, but I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whoever says to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whoever says you fool shall be in danger of hellfire." And so we know that when you look at these words, if you're angry, if any of us, we have angry with his brother, it says without a cause, you'll be in danger of judgment. Whoever says to his brother, Raca. Now we don't use the word Raca. We recognize that. Anybody here go around calling anybody Raca? I never have. But we might use a term like moron or airhead or stupid. That's what it's referring to. So it's talking about just being rude and calling people names and saying that they don't have smarts or whatever it might be. But then we get down to whoever says you fool, and that term means that you look at people in a way, or look at a person in a way, that you've decided in your mind that person has absolutely no value, that their life is of no value, and you treat them that way. You treat them as if they have no value to their life. And so that means then, if we do that, if anyone does that, you're in danger of hellfire, the second death. So we recognize that we need to be careful about whether we're angry at people, whether we call people names, whether we ever think so little of someone that we just assume or we think of them as having no value. That's not how God views people. So it's important that we view people the way God does, that we view relationships the way God does, and that we strive to have godly relationships in this life as God's people. I always like to say that with the help of God's Spirit, the power of God's Spirit, if we can't have good relationships, who can? And so it's important that we understand the godly principles to live by in our relationships and that we strive to apply them. So the first one, making sure I get everyone's attention. Point number one, long suffering. Now, we've talked some about this before, and sometimes I joke about this fruit of God's Spirit, that it's one that's difficult to ask for, but it is something that is important in relationships. If you are married and you believe that your spouse has done something against you, are you long-suffering? If you have children and you believe they've done something against you, are you long-suffering? And children, if you think your parents have mistreated you or done something wrong, are you long-suffering toward your parents? Do you know what long-suffering means? It doesn't sound very pleasant, but it is a fruit of God's Spirit. And it is a godly principle that each and every one of us should apply in our lives, in our relationships. So let's look first and foremost, just so you know I'm not making it up, it is a fruit of God's Spirit, Galatians chapter 5. Not too long ago, I gave a sermon on joy. And that's a much easier topic to speak about when we're talking about fruits of God's Spirit. It's easy if you say about the fruits of God's Spirit, what would you like more of? Well, I want more joy. How many of you would like more love? Like to express more love in a godly way? Like to receive love in a godly way? We want more love. Most of us do. It's a nice thing. It's a beautiful thing. How many of you want more peace? Anybody not want more peace? You know, those things are easy for all of us to agree to, but we get down to long-suffering. It is a fruit of God's Spirit. Of course, Paul in this chapter, he's talking a lot about walking in God's Spirit. If you have it, use it. Don't fulfill the lust of the flesh. He goes through these works of the flesh, and he gets down to verse 22, and he says, "But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such there is no law." In other words, when he says against such there is no law, I like to think of it this way, that in our society there has to be certain parameters or laws so that people don't hurt themselves or hurt others. That's why we have speed limits, because some of us would drive as fast as we could drive if there were no limits. You thinking of someone? Some would do that, and so we have to put limits, and so people don't hurt themselves or hurt others, and sometimes they seem like funny limits. I know that when we drive to services in Pennsylvania, on up to the Maryland line, it's 65, and then boom, 55. And it tells you 55 for the next 23 miles. And we try to get out early for services, but when you have the family and everybody's getting things and taking care of things and you try to get out by 8 o'clock and we don't always make it, we hit this 55 speed limit and for the next 23 miles and we're thinking, oh, we don't go much over it. And we're thinking, well, we want to be to church on time. It's important to be to church on time, but 55, that's slow. Anyway, there's these parameters, these laws, so that we don't hurt ourselves or hurt others. With the fruits of the Spirit, there are no laws about having more. You can't have so much love that it's a crime, or that you're breaking some kind of law, or so much joy, or so much long-suffering. So when we talk about this fruit of God's Spirit, when we talk about this principle, godly principle, spiritual principle, for helping us to have good relationships, how are we doing with this long-suffering? You've heard me talk about from time to time that it's appropriate and good to take our Bibles and to open them up when we kneel down to pray and sometimes pray the Scriptures. And there's a section of Scriptures that I like to pray in Colossians, probably the one I've prayed the most. I don't know for sure, but Colossians chapter 1. Let's look at this. Colossians chapter 1 here. This is actually a prayer of Paul for the brethren who were at Colossae, where he says in verse 9, Colossians 1 and verse 9, says, "For this reason we also, since the day we heard it, do not cease to pray for you and to ask that you may be filled with the knowledge of His will in all wisdom and spiritual understanding." Now, if Paul prayed this for the brethren at that time, we read it, and it's a good thing for all of us to pray for, to be filled with the knowledge of God's will in all wisdom and spiritual understanding, that you may walk worthy of the Lord. And we understand that to mean that you may live your life worthy of the Lord, fully pleasing Him, being fruitful in every good work, and increasing in the knowledge of God, strengthened with all might according to His glorious power, for all patience and long-suffering with joy." So when you read through these things, it's just some incredible things that any of us as Christians would desire. We should want to be filled with the knowledge of God's will. Of course, it's talking about understanding spiritual principles, understanding Scriptures, knowing what's right and wrong, making judgments, decisions based upon what's right, being filled in all wisdom and spiritual understanding, fully pleasing God, being fruitful in every good work. I mean, these things just sound great. And then he gets down to the end and he says, strengthened with all might. And he knows that it takes strength so that you can be patient and long-suffering with joy. And we talked before about trials, and James says, count it all joy when you go through various trials. And that's a very mature Christian attitude. Long-suffering is a mature Christian fruit. If we bear the fruit of long-suffering, it demonstrates maturity, a very mature Christian attitude or viewpoint or outlook or characteristic. It's the best way to term it, because it's a characteristic of God. We understand that. And when we talk about long-suffering, it's important to understand what we're talking about, because it's talking about a state of emotional calm, a state of emotional calm during provocation or misfortune, without complaining or without irritation. So a state of emotional calm in the face of provocation or misfortune without complaining or irritation. It's having patience. It's being patient. In the Greek, oftentimes when I find an idiom that helps to express it, I try to use it. And I always like to do this to make sure everybody understands what an idiom is. I don't know what in Spanish, there might be certain idioms that you understand or use. In English, sometimes we say things like, it's raining cats and dogs. That's one that everybody recognizes, because if you say that, then you understand it's raining really hard. Nobody thinks it's raining cats and dogs. It's raining really hard. Well, in the Greek, if they wanted to express this type of idea, they would say that your heart is remaining seated. Your heart is remaining seated. Because they understood that the heart was the center of emotion, just as far as the way it's described. And so that's we understand that it's from our thoughts. There might be feelings that our body feels. Sometimes when we get emotional, our stomach might get upset and that kind of thing. But it's from our mind where the thoughts are generated. But it says that the heart is seated, or to keep one's heart from jumping. And it's if you're in a situation where you might want to react in anger or in revenge or to take avenge or to get even, but you don't. And what it means, long-suffering is even more than that, because it means that you might even have the right to take revenge. In other words, your spouse may have done something that you know is wrong and they know is wrong, and maybe you like to keep score. We talk about that sometimes, where if you keep track of everything that the other person does so that you know the next time you want to do something to them, it's just getting even. They don't owe you anything because you're just getting even with them. You remember that two World Cups ago when that announcer became famous because he, every time a goal was made, he would say, "Score!" Long-suffering means we don't keep score. If somebody has done something against us, our heart stays seated. We don't react. We don't lash out. We don't tell them how wrong they are. We don't tell them that we can't wait until we pay them back. Long-suffering means that we don't keep that kind of thoughts in our minds. It literally means to be forbearing. One commentary says it's the quality of a person who is able to avenge himself, yet refrains from doing so. So it means to be tolerant, to give clemency. It means to not seek revenge. So recognize that these attitudes that I'm talking about, they go against human nature, especially with the inspiration of Satan. Satan prods humanity to get even. Well, today we hear all about road rage. We hear all about people, I say all about, I'm talking in generalities, but just recently there was the kid who killed his grandparents because they took his iPod away from him. No, he lashed out in anger. So to never do this, or let me put it this way, to have this characteristic of long suffering, it comes from God's Spirit. It goes against human nature. So it's something that we have to be aware of. So my question for you today, it's not, have you ever heard of long suffering? It is, are you applying long suffering in your relationships? Because it's a godly principle to live by. And every one of us need to recognize we cannot develop godly character in other people. We're responsible for our character, for our godly character. So recognize that we might suffer because of what other people do. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever had anyone do anything against you or in any way offend you or say anything bad about you that you knew wasn't true. Maybe your spouse has never crossed you or made you angry. But sometimes we will be tested in long suffering. If you haven't been yet, you will be tested because it is a characteristic of God. And it's a characteristic that as Christians we should develop. And every one of us as Christians, we should desire long-suffering from God. What if God kept score? Because we know, he says, if we repent, he will remove from us our sins as far as east is from the west. God is long-suffering toward us. God is patient toward us. And that's also something that I give thanks for. That God is a very patient God. And he's a very long-suffering God. Notice 2 Peter chapter 3. God ever had it with us, we would be gone. Second Peter chapter 3, verse 14, it says, therefore, beloved, looking forward to these things, be diligent to be found by him in peace, without spot and blameless. And consider that the long-suffering of our Lord is salvation. And Peter goes on to say that Paul has told us the same thing. But consider that the long-suffering of our Lord is salvation. So we should recognize that this characteristic of God allows us salvation. So God has long-suffering. He's long-suffering toward us. And we should learn to be able to be long-suffering towards other human beings. It is an important godly characteristic. Notice in James chapter 5. We see that when you study about long-suffering, oftentimes you'll see the word patient in conjunction with it. James chapter 5, verse 7. Therefore be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, waiting patiently for it until it receives the early and latter rain. And so he's making the point that if you plant a seed, if any of you have done this, I remember when I was a little kid getting a cup at elementary school for a science project and we had to plant a seed in there, and then I stared at it. I don't know how long, 10 minutes maybe. It didn't do anything. And then I had to water it, put it in the sun, give it some time, and something grew. So he's saying that it takes time. Our lives take time. From the time you were baptized until you either die in the faith or Christ returns, and there's a number of years that might go by. For some of us, it might be a lot of years. But there's a number of years that go by. That's what he's talking about. He says, you also be patient. There's the second time that word's come up. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Do not grumble against one another, brethren. Isn't that incredible how often that has to be said? Do not grumble against one another. So he's talking about our brothers and sisters in Christ. When you look around this room, he's saying, don't complain about each other. Don't argue. Don't grumble. There's other verses that say, do all things without complaining. Lose at the chili cook-off without complaining. I've been telling myself that all week. So he says, do not grumble with one another, lest you be condemned. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. So again, Christ will return. We will answer for our words and our actions. And he says, my brethren, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord as an example of suffering and patience. So if you haven't read Jeremiah lately, that's a good book to read about prophets suffering and being patient. And we know that there's the term of the being sawed asunder and various things that took place that they did with patience. In other words, they lived their lives as they knew they were supposed to live them, waiting for the return of Christ. That's what James is emphasizing through this section of Scriptures. Don't become impatient to where you're seeking out new doctrine or get the itchy ears like it's talking about in other sections of scriptures, or don't become impatient and then you lose focus and so you turn inward and start arguing with people or bickering about the congregation or this or that. He's saying be patient, continue doing what you know you're supposed to do, because Christ will return. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. And then he goes on, though, to talk about the prophets as an example of suffering and patience. And the word suffering is the same as long suffering that we looked at in the other scriptures, in Galatians 5, in Colossians 1. It's the same word, that long suffering. So even if they could have done something to take revenge into their own hands or to take action against someone who mistreated them, they didn't do it. So it's a godly principle. It's a fruit of God's Spirit that we should learn to apply in our relationships. The second one I want to talk about today is the principle of reciprocity. The principle of reciprocity. So the word reciprocity, it's used in various ways. One way I know that it was used is my wife used to work at an engineering firm where the engineers had to be certified in various states. And sometime if you were certified in one state, another state would have reciprocity, meaning that if you're certified in Maryland, you'd automatically be certified in Virginia or something of that nature. It basically means if it's valid for one, it's valid for the other. So how would we use this as a spiritual principle in our relationships? It means that there's a proper going back and forth where both are useful for each other. In other words, in whatever relationship you want to talk about, whether it's marriage, friendship, family, with your work co-workers, you're not just taking from the relationship, but you're also giving. You don't just take from the relationship, but you're also giving. Let's notice in Joshua chapter 2 concerning this principle. There's various ways to think of this principle. For example, you may have a friend or someone in your family that when you're together, you can never get a word in edgewise. For some of us, it wouldn't matter. We don't need to talk anyway. But for some of us, we like to talk. And there's some people that it's just very difficult to get a word in once they get going. Well, if you use the principle of reciprocity, it's polite in a conversation to allow other people to talk. You talk, they talk. That would be the principle of reciprocity. You listen, they listen, going back and forth. Here in Joshua chapter 2, you'll remember this is the section with Rahab. Verse 4, it says, "Then the woman, Rahab, she took the two men and hid them." So she said, "Yes," when they asked her about them. "Yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from. And it happened as the gate was being shut when it was dark that the men went out. Where the men went, I do not know. Pursue them quickly, for you may overtake them." Verse 6. "But she had brought them up to the roof and hidden them with the stalks of flax which she had laid in order on the roof. Then the men pursued them by the road to the Jordan, to the fords. And as soon as those who pursued them had gone out, they shut the gate." And so they're out chasing, trying to run down the spies who were hiding up on the roof. Verse 9, "and said," or verse 8, "now before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, 'I know that the Lord has given you the land, that the terror of you has fallen on us.'" That's the terror of the nation of Israel. "And that all the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted because of you." In verse 10, "For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt. And what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were on the other side of the Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. Verse 11, and as soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted, neither did they remain any more courage in anyone because of you. For the Lord your God, He is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. Now therefore I beg you, swear to me by the Lord, since I have shown you kindness, that you also will show kindness to my father's house, and give me a true token, and spare my father, my mother, my brothers, my sister, and all that they have, and deliver our lives from death. Verse 14, so the men answered her, our lives for yours. If none of you tell this business of ours, and it shall be, when the Lord has given us the land, that we will deal kindly and truly with you. And so we know that she let them down and they got away. So they say, our lives for yours in verse 14. And it says, when the Lord has given us the land, we will deal kindly and truly with you. Kindly means that word is not just an emotion or something. It actually means doing something. It denotes actually doing something. So they said, we will do something for you. You've done something for us. We will do something for you. So understand this principle of reciprocity. It is a biblical principle that we do the right thing towards others. In whatever relationship it is, whether it's friendships, we've told our kids for years, of course now they're older, but when they were young especially, we said, people are not your friends if they don't treat you like friends over and over, not just one time. Anyone can make a mistake. But if they don't treat you like a friend, eventually you have to realize they're not your friend. And we encourage them to treat their friends friendly. And that if you want friends, to be friendly. And things like that, those principles. But kindly means doing something in whatever relationship it applies to. So in this situation, in the book of Joshua, they were useful to each other. So she saved their lives. And we know that later they saved her life as well. The word kindly, it shows a joint obligation between relatives or friends. It shows a closeness and a loyalty. And it shows that the obligations are largely the same. Now, understand when I say this, I recognize that parents and children, there are different obligations or responsibilities that parents have and that children have, or that husbands have and that wives have. You have different responsibilities with your family as you do with your friends. But what this is saying is that there should be this loyalty and an obligation that goes back and forth in whatever relationship it is. There should be a principle of reciprocity where you do something. So don't just have a relationship to get. People who get married, I just use that as an example, but people who get married just to fulfill their own needs, whatever they might be, whether it's emotional or physical or whatever they want to get to fulfill their needs, usually they end up unhappy because eventually they think they're not getting what they need or they're not getting what they want. Sometimes I have had this not happen often, but occasionally I have someone tell me, I'm not getting what I need from Sabbath services. And the first thing I think of is there has to be an attitude of give. If all of us come to Sabbath services with the attitude of give, what can I contribute? What can I add? What can I give? What can I do to serve at church? God's going to take care of the needs. That's a spiritual principle. God will take care of the needs if we have an attitude of give. So don't go, and this applies to me too, in any relationship, don't go into a relationship to get, with an attitude of get. Remember the principle of reciprocity, of giving. And of course, Christ tells us not just to give in a way of reciprocity, because that means an equal. You give, I give, that kind of thing. You loan me $20, I'll loan you $10, you know, we'll call it even. Reciprocity means it's kind of an equal giving, and that's the principle. But in the New Testament, Christ says, Even more than that, notice in Matthew chapter 5, here in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5, both of the water glasses are on the right side now, I'm confused. Verse 38, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I tell you not to resist an evil person, but whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. And so understand, when I'm talking about this principle, I'm not saying if somebody hits you, go ahead and slug them back. We're talking about a proper relationship and a proper giving in a relationship. But Christ says, don't even resist those who slap you. If they slap your right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. And whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. And so at that time, we understand there was a custom that the Roman soldiers, if they could pull anyone at any time from whatever they were doing and say, carry my shield and my spear for the next mile. And Christ says, if they ask you to do that, say, okay, let me do it for two. Which it would have been hard for me to do, I think, if they just stopped me from doing whatever I was doing, going about my daily business, and all of a sudden I'm carrying someone else's shield and spear. And the attitude that Christ is saying is, go above and beyond. So every time I think of that term, I used to hear that a lot as a young man in God's church. I don't know that we use it so much anymore. But now, every time I hear it, I can't help but think of the movie Toy Story. Has anybody seen that? With the what's the guy's name, Buzz Lightyear, and he's always saying, to infinity and beyond. So, to above and beyond is what we should take away from this principle of reciprocity, is that we go above and beyond, because if somebody asks you, if a friend asks you to help, and it's hard today. I have heard people in the church say that the next time someone asks me to help them move, I'm just going to say no. Even though we're told, don't grow weary of well-doing. We've been in areas before where people move in and out a lot, and it seemed like for a while during the spring and summer, every Sunday is helping someone load up. And my back still hurts from moving the Demarest 4 years ago. That's not true. We're told not to grow weary of good works, and we're told that if somebody asks us to go a mile, go with them too. And look at Luke chapter 17. And here's the place where we do get this principle of going above and beyond, and we're applying this to our relationships. So don't just do what's necessary. For example, wives are told to be a helpmeet. Don't just do the minimum. I don't know what the minimum is to help your husband. But this principle means don't just do the minimum. Husbands, you're told to love your wives. And some men get it in their heads that if they have a job and they're providing a place to live and food for the table, that they've done their job as a husband, that they're loving their family. And we should understand as Christians it goes much deeper than that. So the principle here is this principle of reciprocity, that it goes back and forth, that we're not in relationships just to get, and the Bible tells us to go above and beyond, to infinity and beyond, above and beyond. So verse 10 of Luke 17, so likewise you, when you've done all those things which you are commanded, say, we are unprofitable servants. We have done what our duty was to do. We have done what was our duty to do. And I find that interesting, because most people today, I can't put an exact number on it, but I know that there are people who watch the clock. And when it is time to go home from work, whatever time that might be, they are going home from work. I remember a long time ago, this has been years and years and years ago. I worked at a place where we actually punched the clock. And there used to be people standing there at the clock with their card, waiting for the hand to go up straight like this at 5 o'clock so that they could punch it at 5 o'clock. Not 4:59, but 5 o'clock. And they were out of the building as soon as they got that card punched. But this is telling us if you just do what's required of you, then you're unprofitable. Apply that to your relationships. Your friendships, your family, if you're married, your marriage, whatever it might be. Apply this principle to relationships, this principle of reciprocity and not being it to give, or just to get, I should say, but make sure that you're going above and beyond in your relationships. Let's turn to another principle that we'll recognize in Philippians chapter 2. Another spiritual principle or biblical principle to be applied in relationships that goes against human nature. Philippians chapter 2. Verse 3. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. In lowliness of mind, esteem others better than yourself. That just goes so against human nature. When it says nothing, of course, that means not anything. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit. Now, selfish ambition means a feeling of resentment or jealousy or rivalry. It means rejecting what you know is right in order to put yourself in the best light possible, whether it's true or not. Now, that's what human nature wants to do. The vast majority of human beings, even when they're wrong, they want to defend themselves to somehow make it seem as if what they did wrong was right. Or it was okay for them to do it, for whatever be the reason. Because they have a certain picture of themselves in their mind, and they want people to view them a certain way, and so they defend themselves in whatever it might be that they've done. So this selfish ambition, it means to reject what is right in order to put yourself ahead of others. It's wanting to make people think that you're better than you are. That's human nature. That's what human nature wants us to do. Every one of us should want people to think the best of us. And it's a natural thing. But human nature will make us, even when we're wrong, try to convince people that we're right. And it means doing things for yourself, again, for self. So let nothing be done through this attitude of putting self first before others for any reason or opportunity to make yourself look better. Or from conceit, which is an empty pride, or cheap pride is what it's talking about. So let nothing be done from selfish ambition or this empty, cheap, vain pride. That's the attitudes inspired by Satan that human nature will put into our minds. But we are told as Christians, in lowliness of mind, that means humility, we esteem others better than ourselves. And when we esteem someone, it means that we recognize that they have a surpassing value or an exceptional value to be better. That's literally what it means. And it's appropriate in our relationships to esteem others better. So if you're married, do you esteem your spouse better than you? I like to use marriage. I know that everyone here is not married. Some are. And those who aren't, some want to be. But I use it as an example because if you live with the same person for... Amber, how many years have you been married? Yeah, you live with Randy for 2.5 years. You recognize he might have one weakness. I don't know if you found it yet. But he might have one. So you live with somebody for 20 years or so. You get to know them. You should get to know them. And all of a sudden you realize that they have strengths and they have weaknesses. And the human nature way is to think, wow, you know, over the last 20 years, I've grown in grace and knowledge, but my wife sure hasn't. I'll use her as an example since she's not here. But we are told to esteem others better than ourselves, our spouse, our friends. So that means that we're putting them first, that we're thinking of them first, that we might recognize their needs. We might anticipate their wants. We understand, I don't know if any of you have read the book, the Five Love Languages. I think it's a pretty good book to give a basis of understanding personality types. And we went through it, my wife and I certainly believe that it was accurate for her, that for her to feel loved, she requires time together. And when we haven't had enough time together, it becomes noticeable. She lets me know in a good way. And so we have to spend time together and talking and just being together, doing activities together, that type of thing. So if you esteem someone better, you recognize what it is they need. Not just wants, but needs. And you recognize it and you strive to take care of it. Not just in marriage, but in friendships. Children towards their parents, especially as we get to be teens and we're able to look outside of ourselves better in a good way, we esteem our parents better. We esteem our children. How many of us recognize our children? They are God's children. And I have encouraged my kids, I've told them this many times, that I encourage them to strive to be a better Christian than I am. And we work hard with God's help to set a good example in our home. But I've told them, strive to be a better Christian than I am. And what if in God's kingdom I'm working under one of my kids in some way or serving under them? That's possible. So esteem our kids properly, better than ourselves. And this whole thing, it doesn't mean to beat yourself up and say I'm miserable, I'm a rat, I'm low life, and everybody's better than me. It doesn't mean that. We recognize that there's a healthy attitude towards self as well. But it is talk about recognizing the value of others and not putting yourself before others. It's what it's talking about. Various translations say, don't be in a spirit of strife or vainglory, but in lowliness of mind, esteem others as more excellent than yourself. Another translation says, better than yourself, more significant than yourself. Always considering others as better, maybe more important, as it says in one translation. The Message, I don't use this very often, but it says, don't push your way to the front. Don't sweet talk your way to the top, is what it says. But it says, put yourself aside and help others get ahead. One company I worked with for a number of years, once you reached VP level, you really got great stock options, a good salary, and a new Jaguar. And it was very competitive to get to that level and get that Jaguar. Everybody was talking about the type of Jaguar that they would order. And I didn't make it, by the way. You've never seen me drive a Jaguar. Anyway, they were very competitive to get to certain levels within this company, and they were very much putting themselves in front of whoever they could, whenever they could, and sweet-talking their way to the top or doing whatever they needed to do to get to the top. They had no problems with selfish ambition because it's human nature. But God's nature says, don't be that way. Esteem others better. Another translation says, don't do anything just to get ahead. Don't do it because you're just proud. Instead, be free of pride and think of others as better than yourself. Now, this takes God's spirit. It's a godly principle that every one of us should strive to use in our relationships. This is where I ran out of time in Bedford. So we'll stop here. So that if I do part two, it'll be the same in both congregations. But I want to do make one last point before I conclude. Because this sermon is for you. It's not for your spouse. It's not for your best friend. It's not for others in the congregation. It is for me. And it is for you. So please, brethren, take the challenge. Apply these godly principles to your relationship. Meditate on it this week. Study about it this week. Strive to apply these to your relationship. Ask God for help. And if we're doing that, then every one of us can reap the rewards of godly relationships.